Well, in less than a week, my family and I will be on our way to the Feast of Tabernacles. Actually, by this time, we should actually be there for all the flights and everything. Go in according to it on time. Some of you might be in that same situation. If you haven't left by this time next week, then no doubt you'll be getting pretty close. This time of year always elicits a certain sort of a feel, certain memories. As soon as first you get those first couple of mornings when you get up and it's not, you know, baking outside, and it's just a little bit of coolness in the air, and things are starting to get dried out, and you start to see a few leaves turn, you know it's the fall, right? You know that means the Feast of Tabernacles is here. And I have so many wonderful memories about the feast. Countless memories. We were talking, my mom and I were talking yesterday. My very first airplane flight was also my mom's first airplane flight. That was in 1990, and we flew from Cincinnati to LA and then drove to Palm Springs for the feast. So that was a kind of a special memory. More often than not, though, our trips to the feast were in an orange Oldsmobile, and we headed from Cincinnati down to St. Pete Beach. How many of you ever went to St. Pete for the feast? Okay, quite a few. Yeah, that's a staple for us years ago. We would, if everything worked out right, we used to go about every other year. I think we went every odd year from 79 to 93. You know, it's kind of a highlight. We go to St. Pete, and then we'd wind up in Dayton. Not Daytona, okay, Dayton, Ohio. You know, nothing against Dayton. It's a nice town, but it's a little industrial town in the middle of Ohio, and it wasn't very exciting feast site per se, but, you know, it was good. But these long rides to Florida, just, you know, they're etched in my mind forever. It was me sitting in the middle. Since I was the littlest, I had to sit on the hump there in the back. My brother usually sat on my left, and my sister on the right. Although that my brother, he was older, he got taller, he sat on the right. Actually, no, wait a minute. That was a bench seat to make a difference. I say, at one point in time, he switched to the other side because there was more leg room behind mom, but I digress. And you know, this was long before Game Boys or DVD players or anything like that, right? You know, we had to play license plate bingo, or we have those little things that you kind of like the Mad Libs sort of things where you have like the invisible marker and you reveal the words, do the word story. One of mom's favorite tricks was she would try to keep us occupied with all these games, but when the tension got so high, I couldn't stand it anymore, she would break out the Sears catalog, and usually came out about that time of year, right? Yeah, you remember that? And you start looking at what you're going to get for yourself for a feast present. Yeah, yeah. So even the packing up of our car was kind of an event, right? Dad would back the Oldsmobile around to the back of the house because he didn't want the neighbors to see that we were loading up and leaving, right? He'd back it up to the back porch, and we'd start loading the car. And we had what was called a Big Mac carrier because it looked like the old styrofoam Big Mac containers, right? And it was about that color. On top of the car, we put the luggage and the rest of the luggage in the back. And we learned over the course of time, pack the tools last because inevitably something would happen to that old Olds and we'd break down and we'd have to work on a little bit. But, you know, we got there. All of these add up to some great memories about the feast. And that's what I want to talk about today. Making great memories at the feast. Making great memories at the feast. I want to start, as we almost always do, when it comes to the holy days, about reading that basic command there in Leviticus 23. So let's turn there. Leviticus 23. And we'll start in verse 1. Leviticus 23 and verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, the feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts." Now, God didn't just jump into it and say, "These are the feasts you should keep." He gave a little reference here. Whose feasts are they? They're God's feasts. They weren't for ancient Israel. They weren't just for ancient Israel, I should say. They aren't just for the Jews. They're not for me. They're not for you. I mean, in a sense of the word, they are, right? But they are not our feasts. They are feasts of the Lord. Think about it this way. If somebody invited you to, say, an anniversary, they're having a celebration of the 25th wedding or 50th wedding anniversary, something like that, or maybe somebody was retiring or some other party, and they invited you and maybe a couple dozen of other friends, you'd go, you have a good time. And then a couple years down the road, somebody asks you about that, you'd say, oh, yeah, I kind of remember that. But for the person whose party it was, well, what do you think they'd think? Oh, yeah, I remember so-and-so. They'd have a whole lot more memory because it was special, because it was for them. You know, God's feasts are awesome. They outline a plan for mankind. And yes, they are for us in that one sense of the word. But whose feast are they? Who are they most important to? Or the most important to the Lord? Continuing on, Leviticus 23 still. Starting in verse 33, it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, saying, The 15th day of the seventh month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days. On the first day there shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it. For 7 days you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. On the eighth day you shall have a holy convocation, and you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. It is a sacred assembly, and you shall do no customary work on it." So here we get an outline here of the Feast of Tabernacles on the eighth day. And we're told, of course, that the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles is a holy day, and the eighth day is a holy day. But days, I guess you would say 2 through 7 then, they aren't actually holy days. But it does say for 7 days you will make this sacrifice. You will make an offering made by fire. Now, of course, we don't offer sacrifice. Right? We understand Jesus Christ is our sacrifice. There's no need for us to do that. But notice that the Feast of Tabernacles occurs all 7 days. It's not just the first day, and then on the eighth day, and then nothing in between. It doesn't say, you know, make an offering on the first day, and then on days 2 through 7, feel free to take time and, you know, go to Disney World or just hang out at the beach and, you know, sit around your condo and twiddle your thumbs and watch TV all day. No, the feast is all 7 days. No, they're not all holy time, but the feast is all 7 days. Now, that's not to say that you can't go out and enjoy the beach after services or go to, you know, whatever amusement park you want to go to, something like that. I do those kinds of things myself. I enjoy it. But we can't let those things, as we heard in the sermonette, come between us and God. We can't let those types of things, our own entertainment, pursuing our own pleasure, as it's worded in Isaiah 58, we can't let that come between us and keeping the feast. It's so important, God repeats it here in verses, starting in verse 39. He says, "Also on the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep the feast of the Lord for 7 days. On the first day there shall be a Sabbath, and on the eighth day a Sabbath." So again, highlighting the fact that those are annual Sabbaths, they're holy days. It says, "And you take for yourselves on the first day of the fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, the boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. You shall keep it as a feast to the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. You shall celebrate it in the seventh month. You shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generation may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." Now here we see some meaning behind the feast revealed. It was to remind Israel being brought out of Egypt. And we understand for us as we look forward and we think about the millennium that is to come, that'll be a time when God delivers mankind from death, right? Which Egypt is a type of death, a type of sin, better said. And so we can think about that, but also notice how many times he repeats the fact, "You shall keep the feast." How many? 7 days. Right? It must be kind of important, you think, if God mentions it over and over, that it's 7 days. Let's turn over to Numbers chapter 29. Numbers 29, starting in verse 12. It says, On the 15th day of the seventh month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work, and you shall keep a feast to the Lord 7 days. You shshall present a burnt offering, an offering made by a fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord, 13 young bulls, 2 rams, 14 lambs in the first year. They shall be without blemish. Their grain offering shall be fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah of each for the 13 bulls, 2/10 for each of the 2 rams, 1/10 for each of the 14 lambs. Also, 1 kid goat as a sin offering besides the regular burnt offering, its grain offerings, and its drink offerings. Now, again, we don't practice burnt offerings. We understand from Hebrews 13, verse 15, it's our words, our praise, our prayer that are offerings that we make to God. But notice how it goes on here in Numbers, verse 17 now. It says, on the second day, present 12 young bulls, 2 rams, 14 lambs in the first year without blemish, and their grain offering and their drink offering. And it goes on and on. Verse 20, on the third day, present 11 bulls. Now, it's interesting that as each day goes on, it's one less bull. And there's, you know, some meaning behind that and that, but that's not what I want to focus on. The fact is, though, there were offerings every day. It didn't stop there after the first day. God repeats this for each day. On the third day, on the fourth day, on the fifth day, on the sixth day, on the seventh day, on the eighth day. Why do you repeat yourself? If you were maybe instructing, let's just use an example of a child, right? You're telling your kids something, hey, you're making this particular recipe, right? Or you're going to go do this particular task, you know, cutting the grass or changing the oil in the car. If there's a key critical step in that process, what do? You repeat it, right? If you have written instructions today, we have bold, we have underline. I didn't necessarily have that in Hebrew, so God repeated it. But why did he do it? It's important. He just wasn't doing that to try to get the word count up because he was getting paid by the, you know, word here because for a book he was publishing or something. He did it because it was important. He wanted to let everybody know the feast is 7 days. Now, there are, of course, legitimate reasons to miss a service, okay? I've had to do that myself. I remember being sick one time as a kid. One feast, we actually had to leave the feast early because my grandfather passed away. And even those things have become, you know, memories etched in my mind. Unfortunately, to be honest, I have missed some feast days because I was worried about things back home, projects I had to work on. So I wasn't there the entire feast time, and I'll go on a little bit more about that later on. But when we choose to pursue other pleasures, anything, any sort of an idol, other than what God told us to do for 7 days, we find ourselves missing out, don't we? You know the old saying, you miss school, you miss out. It's disrespectful to those who are speaking. It's disrespectful for those who are prepared to make services happen. And guess what? It's disrespectful to God. It's disrespectful to God. It might be rather simple point, but it's an important one. In order to make great memories at the Feast of Tabernacles, need to be there every day. Be there every day. Another great way to make memories at the feast is to meet new people. I literally cannot tell you how many people I've met at the Feast of Tabernacles over the years. You know, going back to those days in St. Pete, there were 10, 12, 13,000 people there. And even as a little guy, you know, I was meeting other little friends and stuff, and I don't necessarily know who they all are today or where they are or anything like that, but you met new people. Last year at the feast, I met new people. This year, I know I'm going to meet new people. One particular story I'll share was in 1997. I had gone to the feast in 1996. I had gone to the feast, and I kind of had a rough feast that year because I totaled my car like the week before. And so I wound up having to ride down with somebody else, and I had stitches on my hand, a bandage on my eye, and all that kind of stuff. So 1997, it was kind of a clear slate for me, and I was like, okay, this is going to be a great feast. And I was still in college at that point in time. At this point in time, I had mentioned earlier how I had missed some feast days for some things that I was worried about that had to do with my first year of college. But at this point in time, I was past that. I matured, I think, a bit spiritually, and I said, you know, I'm going to go to the feast. And I'm going to keep the feast. That's all I'm worried about, okay? In fact, to be honest with you, when I went to the feast in 1996, I was in a bad attitude because I'd wrecked my car, but I was also in a bad attitude because I was really hoping to meet girls that year, right? And with this bandage on my eye and on my hand and having to bum a ride from some older guys, boy, was I a catch, right? You know, I didn't meet a single girl that year. So in 1997, I said, you know what? Wipe the slate clean. I'm just going to go to keep the feast. That's it. Not going to think about girls. I'm not going to think about anything else. I'm just going to go to keep the feast. So as it happened, I was still in school, so I was living at home with my mom and dad. At that point in time, I had the nicest car for the trip. I had a big 1986 Lincoln Town Car, and it was we were again one more time going to Florida, and yeah, mom and dad and I cruising down the road and that thing. It was like going to Florida on your living room couch, man. It was comfortable. It was fantastic. And as it happened, we were standing outside of services one day. This was, how many of you ever went to the Tupperware Center in Orlando? You're familiar with Tupperware. Their headquarters was in Orlando, and they had this nice facility, and we were there for the feast. And I remember standing outside, and I think it was before services, and my mom and my sister were kibitzing about something. I don't remember what it was, but it was not a conversation that I was interested in at all. And so I just kind of looked around, and I did, and I saw this girl standing over there by the fountains. I had these nice fountains out front. And it was like something out of the movies, right? You know, everything went into slow motion. You know, the hills are alive with the sound of me. And I looked over and I saw this girl turn and her hair was like, and I thought, Dan, you need to go meet this girl. And so I did. I went over and I started talking to her. And long story short, I asked her to marry me the next year at the Feast of Tabernacles. And she said, yes, she's sitting over there. Now, I don't say this to try to set up any sort of a false hope or wrong idea about the feast, that it's a great place to go and try to get hitched up, right, or find romance or anything like that. But I am saying that the feast is a great place to go and meet new people. It's a great place to go and meet new people. If you walk up to a group of strangers and say hello, I virtually guarantee you will walk away with those people not being strangers. And odds are pretty good. You might have an invite to go out to dinner or some sort of activity or get to know somebody a little bit better. Turn over to Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy 16. We often turn to this scripture on holy days because we think about offerings, and that's a good place to look at them. But I actually want to back up a few verses in Deuteronomy 16. Start in verse 13. Deuteronomy 16 and verse 13, it says, "You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days," again, that reminder, "when you have gathered from your threshing floor and from your winepress, and you shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, and the Levite, the stranger, and the fatherless, and the widow, who are within your gates." God makes specific mention of some groups of people here. He talks about your family. Of course, that makes sense. Talks about servants. Again, in that culture and time, servants were sort of quasi-family. So he talks about strangers or others amongst your midst. You know, and kind of the point of him mentioning strangers here is this. There shouldn't be any. There shouldn't be any amongst us who are strangers. In other words, we should all feel welcome, and we should do our part to make others feel welcome. There shouldn't be anyone who has nobody to go out and have a meal with. There shouldn't be anyone who goes back and sits in their condo or the hotel and says, wow, I wish I had something to do tonight. God says, remember the stranger. He says, look out for them. Verse 15, 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you surely rejoice. Again, a reminder, the feast is at full 7 days, but also a command to rejoice. A command to rejoice, which might seem like an odd thing, right? You know, you don't have to tell most people, you know what, you need to go out and have more fun in life. Most people do a pretty good job of that themselves. But sometimes, you know, it can be hard to smile. You know, we've seen people, perhaps you've been the person who's there at the feast, but you're hanging on by the thread, man, and people just have no idea what you're going through. We need to look out for people. Maybe it wasn't a great year for you financially, and you don't have a lot of second tie to spend, and you can't go out to the nicest places to eat, etc. It doesn't mean that you can't talk to people. Doesn't mean you can't meet new people. This wasn't at the feast, but one year, I think it was actually at a winter family weekend, it was the same sort of a principle. There was an older woman who was sitting alone, didn't look like she had anybody with her. She had a handicap. So another family and I, well, we invited her to go out with us. And during that evening, she had so many stories. And this gal was a hoot and a half to be around. And we just had a wonderful time. And later on, you know, we met that gal's family, and they told us how much they appreciated, and their mom appreciated having such a great memory. God doesn't just tell us, keep your tithe so you can go have fun. He says, rejoice. He says, remember the stranger, remember the fatherless, remember the widows. Sometimes that means maybe we got to step outside our comfort zone. Maybe we are not people who normally goes up and talks to people. Maybe we find ourselves being the one people come up and talk to us, and we have a difficult time finding ways to open conversations. But you know, the Bible reminds us of something important in this regard. That's over in Proverbs 18. Proverbs 18. Proverbs 18, verse 24. Proverbs 18, verse 24 says, a man who has friends must himself be friendly. Just read the first part of the verse there. You know, this is solid advice for any type of the relationship, any time of year. It doesn't matter if you're hoping to maybe meet somebody. If you just are alone, if whatever your station in life, whether you're married, whether you're single, rich, poor, this is good advice. You know, to be a friend, to make friends, we need to be friendly. If you sit in a corner with a nasty scowl on your face, look like you're not happy to be there, guess what? Don't be surprised if nobody comes up and invites you out to dinner. They're afraid you might bite them. Sometimes you might even make friends by accident. friends by accident. Imagine the scenario, if you will, and I've seen this happen a few times over the years of the feast. Oftentimes, you know, there's a little bit of shortage on seats, right? Find things a little bit crowded, and we go in and we save our seats. And we come back and we go to sit down and we notice, uh-oh, somebody moved my stuff. Houston, we have a problem, right? So you look over at the guy standing there where your seats used to be and say, hey, buddy, did you move my stuff? What kind of answer do you think you might get? Do you think he's going to feel like being a friend? You just set a tone for that relationship. Well, maybe his answer is, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I did move your stuff. We needed three seats, and where yours were sitting, there was one on one side and two on the other, so the usher told me it was okay to go ahead and move them. And now we're ready to bite somebody's head off because he did what the usher told him to do, right? Of course, on the other hand, you could say when you get there, oh, hey, I thought I put my stuff over here earlier. Do you know what happened? And it's a much different tone, isn't it? Person could say, oh, yes, you know, I talked to the usher. He told me to go ahead and move it. Oh, okay. Oh, by the way, my name's Dan. Where are you from? You know? And we can be and do a lot of things to show ourselves friendly, even in the small sorts of things. Set a friendly tone for that conversation, even if you're not looking to go out and make friends. Be open to that possibility. When it comes to making great feast memories, don't forget, there are no strangers at the feast. There are no strangers. And do your part to be a friendly face that someone would like to meet. One of the other great ways to make memories at the feast is to find a way to serve. As I mentioned before, we found ourselves going to Florida a lot over the years for the feast. And long before I was a feast coordinator, I helped out at Panama City Beach on sound. And more often than not, I was working on the AV crew. And sometimes I was running video, sometimes audio. And I was just, you know, I did everything from being a gopher who went and ran wires and taped stuff down to being the guy who was over sound. But one of those years in between, I was assisting a fella who we'd had some feedback issues with the sound there. If you've ever been to PCB, it's a huge box, which is terrible for acoustics, right? And so we had feedback coming off the back of the walls. So what the fellow who was running sound that year decided, he said, what I want to do, he says, I want to build this huge wooden platform sort of a thing, this truss, and we're going to actually mount the speakers to that, and we're going to hang it from the ceiling. And it's about 20 feet high up there, right? You know, you're not just getting there off of a stepladder, maybe, you know, 25, 30 feet high. And so the only thing he hadn't worked out was exactly how we were going to hang that truss. So we got there and we started looking around. And first of all, we had to figure out how to get up there because the stepladders, you couldn't buy a stepladder tall enough. There wasn't anything to get there. We looked around and there was a scissors lift parked over in the bay. And I'm not necessarily recommend you do this, but sometimes it's easier to seek forgiveness than ask permission. So fortunately, I knew how to operate a scissors lift. We went up there. We got on it. We took it over to where the stage was. We went up to the top. It had drop ceilings like this. We looked around up there, and there were steel girders. So went to the hardware store. We bought some one-inch iron pipe, some steel cable, some U-bolts, and we made ourselves a brace up there, and we put these things down, and we got it all hung up. And by the time the people from the convention center got there and saw what we did, they said, how did you do that? And we kind of looked at each other and said, maybe don't ask too many questions. And they were okay with it, and it went on. You know, everything was fine. Again, I'm not recommending anybody do that necessarily that way. But, you know, the guy that was running sound that year, you know, we made a great memory together. And we talk about that story still. And it brings back a lot of laughter. Serving gives us a great opportunity to make memories. Serving gives us a great opportunity to make memories. Another one I'll share with you, I think I was 10 years old. And we were at the feast in Dayton. Again, not necessarily a highlight you know, destination spot anybody thinks of when they think of the Feast of Tabernacles. But by hook or by crook, I can't remember how, my mom convinced me to be in the children's choir that year. And so we went up there and we practiced. I still remember the song, Morning Has Broken. I remember that song. And I just, you know, I did it. I wasn't thrilled about being in the choir. I'm still not much of a singer, you know, but I did it. And I have to admit, I enjoyed it. It was kind of fun. And when I got back to my seats that day, I don't know who she was, but this older lady behind me, she said, I just want to thank you for going up there and singing. It was just so beautiful. Just really, really enjoyed that, you know? When we serve, we create opportunity to make great memories, you know? Rather than just showing up a couple minutes before services and ducking out straight after, you know, there's always need for some help somewhere. Might be in the mother's room. Might be on ushering, might be on parking. By the way, if anybody listening out there is going to Hawaii and you can help on parking, please email me. We need more people for parking. You know, you might be a greeter. You know, it's a great way to meet literally everybody. You'll see everyone who comes through those doors. There's other ways to serve you might not have thought about as well. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 14. Deuteronomy 14. Deuteronomy 14, starting in verse 22. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. Says, you shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain in the field that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, and tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil and the firstborn of your herds and of your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. But if the journey is too long for you, so that you are not able to carry the tithe, or if the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far from you when the Lord your God has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money, take the money in your hand, and go to the place where the Lord your God chooses. And you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires. You shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. So we see a lot going on here, right? We see principles for tithing established. We see this command to rejoice again. And you might be thinking to yourself, okay, Dan, that's all great and fine, but what's this got to do with serving? Notice that phrase there in verse 26. It's repeated twice. It says, you spend your money on whatever your heart desires. The guy that I was assisting with sound that year, whose idea it was to hang those speakers up, mentioned we went to the hardware store, bought probably $100, $150 worth of cable, pipe, all that kind of stuff. Anyone who paid for that? He did. His heart desired to serve God's people by providing them the best sound experience he could provide them. Now, you can go out and spend your money on an expensive meal, you know, go to an amusement park, a nice bottle of, you know, wine or whatever you want. That's okay. That's fine. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. But a good question to ask yourself is there something I can do with my excess tithe to serve anyone else? Is there something I can do with that excess tithe to serve someone else? What does my heart really desire? Last year, I think it was last year, it might have been 2 years ago, I was in Panama City Beach. There was an older gal there who was alone. And she was in good health and that and getting around and everything. But she seemed like she might not have a lot of money. And so I had a fellow come up to me And he said, hey, you know, I've seen this gal around, and I just think that maybe she might need a little bit of help, maybe to enjoy the feast a little more. And he said, I'd like to make a donation. He said, but I don't want to do it. I just want to be anonymous. And I said, okay. You know, and I knew the fellow, and I knew it was, you know, his intentions and motive was pure and things. So I went over to her after services one day. I'd said hi to her before, but I sat down and started talking with her, got to know her. And then I said, by the way, I said, I have something that someone asked me to give you. And I handed it to her, and she opened the envelope. And there were tears in her eyes. You know? There were tears in her eyes because somebody had thought about her. And it was not a small amount of money. It was several hundred dollars. And she was overwhelmed by the fact that somebody thought about her. But you know what the really funny part was? She didn't need the money because as she was standing there, she said, this is so strange. And she reached into her pocket and she pulled out an envelope. It had the exact same amount of money of what I had just given her. And she said, I've got more than I know what to do with. She said, can you make use of this and take care of somebody with this? And I said, yes, ma'am, we'll do that. And so we went and we found a need to fill with that. One last scripture on this point, Galatians 5. Galatians 5. Galatians 5, verse 13, it says, for you, brethren, have been called to liberty. Only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, Paul is working through some issues that were going on in Galatia, some things about circumcision and all that. And he points out that, you know, while we aren't under some of those laws there that were a part of the old covenant, this freedom that we have, it's not just to serve yourself. I have written in the margin of my Bible a note, and I try to write down, if somebody says something that makes a particular point to me, I write it down in the margin of my Bible, and I usually put their initials so I remember who said it, but I didn't put their initials by this one. I think I know who said it, but I won't say because I'm not sure. But by this scripture, they made mention, the freedom here means we are free to serve. We're free to serve. We aren't under any obligation to spend our time or our tithe helping others. But by the same token, I think it's worth considering, what are we doing with both our time and our tithe? If there's any way that you can serve others at the feast, whether it be through finances, through your time, maybe just a few minutes of conversation, consider how you might serve others. Serving at the feast in any capacity, whether it's helping out with a duty of some sort, spending time to talk who those are alone, maybe offering a little financial assistance through someone. All of these are great ways to serve and make memories at the feast. Now, I have to be honest that not all my memories from the feast are necessarily about exciting stuff we did or even good times. I mentioned, you know, my grandfather passing away. But, you know, as a kid, I tend to be fixated on the different things, the amusement parks, the feast gifts we got, and all that kind of stuff. And some of the events we went to, and those are good, but you know, sometimes some of the best memories are out of the hard times, because it's out of those adversities that are born these future memories, stories for encouragement. I'll share one of mine. When I was in high school, I was taking a physics class. Now, I was a junior, and normally this class was only reserved for seniors. But a buddy of mine and I, we sat down with a guidance counselor, and we talked to him, and they begged us, and they let us take this class as juniors. So I was, you know, privileged to just be in that class in the first place. But when I told my teacher that I was going to be gone for a couple weeks for the feast, it was not met with a friendly response. My teacher told me, said, "Dan, there is no way you're going to keep up. You're going to flunk out of this class." And in an effort to make my life as miserable as she possibly could, she gave me a stack of homework about this high, right? And by the way, this is well long before the internet. You know, I couldn't Google help. I didn't have any family that had taken these classes before, so they weren't really sure on you know what I was working on. But she gave me this mountain of paperwork, and we were going to be gone 2 weeks. And she said, "We're going to cover the next two chapters in the next 2 weeks. You need to be fully up to speed when you get back." I learned later, after the feast was over, that on the first day of classes I was absent, she announced to the rest of the class, "We're going to bury Dan while he's gone. We're going to bury him. I'm going to make him so far behind he can never catch up." Well, while I was at the feast, I worked and I worked and I worked on my physics homework. I probably spent 3 to 4 times as much time on that as anything else, any other math, any other English. But by the time I got back, I was up to speed on those two chapters. I walked in class that first day, maybe not as familiar with all the concepts as I wanted to be, but at least enough I knew what I was talking about. Or to some degree, but I was ready to be, you know, buried and make up work. But you know what was interesting? While I was gone, the rest of the class, other, I think it was about 15 kids in the class, they struggled. They struggled. And guess what? They didn't even finish the first chapter. They didn't even finish the first half of the first chapter. They didn't get past the first premise of the first chapter while I was gone. As a consequence, I kind of sat there in physics and twiddled my thumbs for the next 2 weeks while I waited for everyone else to catch up. Go to Exodus 14. Exodus 14. I actually went on to have a very good relationship with that particular teacher. She was an interesting lady, and I respected her, but yeah, that was something I never will forget. Exodus 14, verse 5, says, "Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, and they said, 'Why have we done this that we have let Israel go from serving us?'" Of course, you're familiar with what this story is, right? God is bringing Israel out of Egypt. Finally, Pharaoh says, "Okay, you can go." And as soon as they're gone, he says, "What are we doing? We need to go get them," right? So he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. Also, he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with the captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. I actually like the King James Version better here. It says, "The children of Israel went out with a high hand." In other words, they weren't scared. Now, admittedly, when they got parked kind of into a corner there at the Red Sea, they got scared again. But at this moment in time, they went out with that high hand. They put their trust in God to see them through. Have you ever encountered anyone whose heart was hardened? You ever met a Pharaoh? A teacher that wanted to bury you in homework? A boss who maybe was just looking for an excuse to get rid of you. Maybe someone who just made a snide comment, "Why on earth are you taking vacation in October? Why don't you take it in July like a normal person?" Right? Now, I mentioned that I had to leave the feast early one year when my grandfather died, but unfortunately, before that had happened, he had died unexpectedly, so It's not like, you know, I was expecting him to die and I was staying back. But that feast, I had missed quite a few days because it was my first year in college. And I was really worried. I was worried because I was going to get falling behind. Now, this is, mind you, after the high school incident with my physics teacher. Here it is a couple years later. I was actually already baptized now at this point. And I had this fear about falling behind at school. And so, you know, I stayed back home and I went to the first holy day. We were down in Louisville or Lexington, Kentucky. And so it was an easy drive to get there and back. And then I went back home and I was there for the middle part of the feast. And as I said, wound up having to go back home on the eighth day. And, you know, I did the assignments and everything I needed to do. But the funny part about it is I actually didn't do all that great on those assignments. And I got done what I needed to do. But I remember being filled with regret that I had missed part of the feast that year. And I promised myself I'd never do it again. And we've all had our own version of Pharaoh. You know, I had mine. You've perhaps had yours. I've had bosses who were fuming mad at me. One year I had to rearrange all of our flight schedule at the very last minute. Cost me every bit of excess tithe I had that year to change our flights because of a particular issue that was going on where I worked. But you know what I've never had since that little mistake I made in college? I've never looked back and said, wow, you know what? I wish I would have stayed home instead of going to the feast. Never thought it. Never thought it. When we think back about these difficult situations that we faced, sometimes our greatest memories are not of an amusement park ride or a good meal or even a great message we heard. But it's how God delivered us, led us out with a high hand so that we could keep his feasts. The feast is a wonderful place to make great memories. But rather than rely on time and chance, there are some things that we can do to help make these great memories. And they're not just about fun activities, although those are certainly great things to have memories of. First thing we need to remember is we need to be there at the feast every day. Every day. It's 7 days, and we need to be there intent on drawing closer to God, honoring him, worshiping him, offering our sacrifice. You make great memories by meeting new people. Helps to be friendly, to get to know other folks. And remember, there should not be any strangers there. We are all part of the body, that same family. And we can make great memories when we choose to serve. If we can't serve others with our time, perhaps we can serve them financially, or vice versa, or perhaps even both. And last, but most definitely not least, think about the things and the times where it might have been difficult. Maybe we thought we weren't going to make it, but somehow God delivered us, provided a way of escape from our own personal Pharaoh. So that we could go and keep his feast. Wherever you're headed this year, hope you have a fantastic feast, and I hope you take some time and make some great memories.